So today we come to the end of our series on the season of creation, and we're going to be deviating a little bit, actually completely, from a principle that I set out on the first week of the series. You might remember I spoke about the challenge of taking the lectionary readings and trying to hear the voice of creation speaking in texts where we would not normally look for it. Those weren't the lectionary readings. Today I chose the readings I wanted because I thought it was really important to finish this series with the idea of hope. Let's face it, the subject of the state of creation isn't always one that is filled with hope. The World Health Organization has noted that increasing degradation of ecosystems through global temperature change, through deforestation, through pollution of land, sea, and air, through loss of biodiversity, increased salination of arable land, and the list goes on, that all of that is having a measurable effect on mental health and well-being, an effect both direct and indirect. In a few weeks' time, we're going to be celebrating the work of Frontier Services, and the bush chaplains of Frontier Services know all too well the deep mental health challenges arising from struggles on the land and struggles from the environment, whether from increasingly frequent and severe droughts or bushfire or flooding. And our partner churches in the Pacific speak of the mental and the physical stresses of dealing with depleting fish stocks, rising sea levels, and loss of fertile land to salination. And climate anxiety, especially amongst youth and young adults, is such that both the Australian Psychological Society and the Australian Medical Association have identified it as a central mental health challenge for our time. So hope and the state of creation are not ideas that naturally go together very easily. But Paul wrote to the Corinthian church, these three remain: faith, hope, and love. I've recently been watching the Netflix adaptation of Neil Gaiman's The Sandman. I don't know if anyone else has been watching that. And there's a scene in which the main character, Morpheus, faces Lucifer in hell, who challenges him, "I am the dark at the end of everything, the end of universes, gods, worlds, of everything. What will you be then?" And after a long silence, Morpheus simply replies, "I am hope." Hope remains. But how? Where do we find that hope? The hope that led Jeremiah to buy the field of promise when the farm was sold, as our hymn put it. Where do we find the hope that persists when overwhelming forces would overcome it? We should perhaps start by noting something that hope isn't. Hope isn't denial. It isn't ignorance. Hope doesn't come from pretending that the problem isn't real or that it isn't serious. You'll have heard these words before, addressing the World Economic Forum back in 2019. Greta Thunberg said, "Adults keep saying we owe it to young people to give them hope. But I don't want your hope. I don't want you to be hopeful. I want you to panic. I want you to feel the fear I do every day, and then I want you to act. I want you to act as you would in a crisis." the sort of hope she was referring to there, that she saw being offered to her generation, was a fake hope in her eyes, a fake hope because it was not based on a realistic assessment of the situation or on any actions that would reflect that sort of realism. Her words actually reminded me of the letter of James and the attitude that James condemns when he writes, "If a brother or sister is naked or lacks daily food, and you say to them, 'Go in peace, keep warm, eat your fill,' but don't supply their bodily needs, what good is that?" Hope is not denying the problem or burying your head in the sand and hoping that it will go away. When Jeremiah bought that field, he knew that it was occupied by an invading force and that it was worthless. Hope wasn't ignorant, but hope bought the field anyway. So where does hope for creation come from? And I'm going to suggest, and I really feel like I'm channeling Stuart here, if you've heard him preach a few times, you'll know what I mean, that when it comes to hope and faith, there are two extremes that we need to avoid. Stuart often says that. Each extreme holding elements of truth, but both of which need to be held on to, acknowledging the tension one of the other. The first of these extremes, these poles, is to base all of our hope simply on the statement that God will fix it. God will fix it takes two common forms in Christian thought. The first, often referred to as Noah theology, based on God's promise at the end of that story that God will never again destroy the earth. It's a theology which simply says God has promised it will not happen. Popular, understandably, amongst those in our world who have less power. Faced with impotence against the power of multinational interests and great nations, it's appealing to simply say, "But my God is bigger still, and God has said." And the second, God will fix it, I think of as revelation theology. The mindset that says, there's no need to protect the environment because Jesus is going to come back and replace everything and there'll be a new heaven and a new earth, so this one really doesn't matter. That's a theology popular amongst the wealthy and the powerful, for it absolves them, us perhaps, of any responsibility to rein in destructive overconsumption. Both of those have truth in them, but we cannot hold solely to that pole. The other pole, if one is God will fix it, the other is humanity will fix it. A combination of arrogance and magical thinking that assumes that future technological advances will solve all of the problems that we create. It doesn't matter what we do now because generations to come will be able to repair any damage we might inadvertently have done. Somewhere between those two poles, somewhere between the abdication of responsibility to rely solely on the expectation of a miracle and the arrogance of expecting a different sort of miracle, somewhere between those poles lies the path I believe that Paul is pointing us towards in Romans chapter 8. Not, of course, that Paul was speaking of contemporary environmental issues. He didn't need modern science to see that even in his day, creation was groaning, as he put it, in pain. Subjected to futility, in bondage, the words he uses, and waiting. Waiting with eager longing. But waiting not just for God to wave a metaphorical wand, nor for humanity to fix everything. Not just for God or just for us. Creation, Paul wrote, is waiting for the revealing of the children of God. Creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the children of God. Not God that creation is waiting for, and not humanity. Neither of those things, at least in and of themselves. Creation waiting for humanity to be revealed for what it truly is, or could be, or should be, or will be. Unveiled as the children of God. Creation waiting eagerly for the time when we are finally seen to be what God always intended us to be. God's children, all of us. Co-creators with God, stewards in partnership with God in the care of the garden of God's creation. Waiting to see what God has been doing in and through humanity in the work of the salvation of all things. For God so loved the world, Jesus said, that God gave God's only Son. Except he didn't say world, he said cosmos. For God so loved all things, all creation, that God gave God's Son. Or as Paul put it in the letter to the church at Colossae, through Jesus, God was pleased to reconcile to God's self all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace through the blood of his cross. So creation is waiting for this unveiling, this fulfillment. And to describe that waiting, Paul writes, we know the whole of creation has been groaning in labor pains until now. Seeing that not everything is right with creation, Paul describes its suffering as labor pains, as something that will pass and from which something amazing and new will emerge. Now, I and some of you share with Paul the advantage of never having actually experienced labor pains. And I do wonder whether a female author of his day who faced the significant dangers of pregnancy, I found reading around for this sermon that it's estimated that 1 in 3 women in Roman times who reached childbearing age would die in childbirth of one of their, on average, 6 or 7 children. I wonder if a woman facing that would have chosen the same image as Paul did. But it's chosen, I believe, because the pain of labor is a pain which comes with hope, with expectation, with the promise of something that has not yet been seen. Because it is a pain which is ultimately creative. The hope for all of creation. Not just that God will step in and fix everything and sweep it away and replace it with creation, heaven and earth 2.0. Or that humanity in its wisdom and creative genius will always be better at finding solutions than it is at creating problems. Seriously, that is not a bet I would want to take. The hope of creation is that the suffering it is going through is a transition. That what God has begun in and through and with us, what God has begun in the life and death and resurrection, what God has begun will come to its finished form, will be revealed. The hope that creation itself will obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. The hope that creation, all of creation, will receive what we have been given. It's a biblical principle I often refer to, that we are blessed so that we might bless others, that we are loved so that we might show love, that we have been shown grace so that we might share it, that we have been set free so that we might liberate others. That is the hope for which creation is longing, that we, God's children, and ultimately all of God's children, will so reflect the glory that God has given us, the love, the grace, the freedom that God has given us, that we will so reflect those things, so fulfill our calling to be God's children, to be what God has made us, that the whole of creation will be touched. That the whole of that cosmos so loved by God will reflect God's glory. Paul doesn't tell us how that works. I'm fairly sure that's because he had no more idea than you or I. What we have seen or understood is not hope. But when we hope for what is not yet seen or understood, we wait, perhaps with patience. Amen.